Spanish flu epidemic of 1918-1919. It raged through South Africa in October, November, right at the end of World War I, and a third wave appeared briefly in the middle of 1919, but less devastatingly. That raging through South Africa in October, November 1918 led to this epidemic being dubbed by contemporaries Black October. For every South African, it was a time of frightening terror and mourning. Black October, as I indicated, it outdid in intensity, in its range, and in its deadliness every other epidemic before or since. This vicious pandemic was part of a worldwide pandemic. The total number of people killed by the Spanish flu in 1918-1919 worldwide, we will never know. At the moment, the estimate is perhaps 50 million plus, against which World War I, with its 12 million dead, really is a sideshow. The epidemic raged in three waves around the world. The first wave was relatively light in terms of death. It infected a large number of people, but caused relatively few deaths compared to the number of people struck down by it. The first wave appeared in March, April 1918 in North America and in Europe. And when it appeared in Europe, censorship, wartime censorship, suppressed news that it had broken out, except in Spain, which was not a belligerent in World War I. And so the newspapers picked up the accounts of this wide-ranging epidemic in March, April 1918, and it appeared that it emerged from Spain. Hence, quite incorrectly, it was then dubbed Spanish influenza, and the name has stuck, to the consternation and dismay of my Spanish companions, who write at great length about this epidemic, almost in a way to prove that it wasn't Spanish in origin. But literally, you give a dog a bad name, and the name has stuck. But it is an entirely inappropriate label. It is a product of wartime censorship. The second wave, the really deadly one, emerged about August 1918, and appeared in South Africa in September and really reached its height in October, hence Black October. If we look at South Africa in 1918, the third wave I mentioned a moment ago appeared in 1919, not as lethal, short-lived, and infected a number of people, but nothing compared to this devastating second wave. If we look at the infection of South Africa, it seems, if we're working backwards from the information that we have, that the tail end of that first wave reached Durban just about August 1918. And we've got evidence of a large number of cases in Durban, in the interior, and then going up to the Witwatersrand to Johannesburg in August, September 1918. Very wide-ranging, but as I indicated, first wave, not particularly deadly. A number of deaths, but not anything very marked. Indeed, one contemporary account spoke of it as being unusually widespread, but relatively lacking in lethality. A few thousand miners went down with it, but relatively few deaths. And so it looks as if the tail end of the first wave hits the eastern and then Transvaal part of South Africa in September 1918. But just as that first mild wave began to ebb in Natal and on the Witwatersrand, the second wave reached South Africa from an entirely different direction. It began to penetrate South Africa through Cape Town. It arrived in Cape Town in September 1918 aboard two troop ships which had left Europe, called at Sierra Leone in West Africa, and there it seems troops and members of the crew were infected. The two ships reached Cape Town in September 1918, and from there the second wave struck. It raced through Cape Town as these newly demobilized soldiers moved around, and then followed them as they returned to their homes around the country by train. In as remote a spot as Tsolo in the Transkei, by the beginning of October 1918, to which a batch of soldiers had returned, demobilized members of the then called the Native Labour Corps, they disembarked from Cape Town, been demobilized, gone by train to the Transkei, and Tsolo, which is really very isolated and very remote. The magistrate of Tsolo was reporting early in October, "Sickness has become rife amongst both races in village and country, and people are being brought into the local doctor by wagons and sledge loads." So a rapid penetration following the railway line, even to these very secluded and isolated places. By mid-October 1918, almost the entire country had been overwhelmed by the same plight as demobilized soldiers carried it around, and then in turn migrant workers fled from spots where the flu had broken out in infected cities, spreading the disease even further, even more extensively into the countryside of South Africa. And it was no longer just a matter of a disease which struck you down and incapacitated you for a couple of days, as in the first wave. The second wave was more and more marked by deaths, a frightening number of them escalating day by day. Bunzaya, cartoonist and Burger, picked up this terror stalking the country in this cartoon from October 1918. In Cape Town, and he was right, he was drawing exactly at this point, in Cape Town, deaths topped 400 per day, which was 40 times greater than the usual daily toll. In Cape Town, normally about 10, 12 people died per day in 1918. 400 people died per day. While at the height of the epidemic in Kimberley, it was estimated that if the deaths were to continue at that rate during the height of the epidemic in Kimberley, the entire population of Kimberley would be wiped out in 16 months. You have to think, conjure up ideas of panic and fear rampant. In the streets of Cape Town, people collapsed. Here's Corporation Street outside the City Hall. You can just see the City Hall's stonework over there. A woman has collapsed and she's been in the street and she's been put up into an ambulance. In Bloemfontein, shops, offices, workshops were closed for want of staff. Public transport and services like the post office were paralyzed, and ailing residents were dropping dead in the streets. In the words of a weekly newspaper in Bloemfontein, "All this week, the hand of the disease has lain heavily on the town, and so uncanny it was the stillness in the streets and shops that we might have been in a city of the dead." Nor was this eeriness of silence limited just to the cities. In the countryside, a report from Cathcart in the Eastern Cape, "For 2 weeks, a great solemn hush has prevailed. No one is to be seen, no one to be heard, no life on the farms, no work on the land. Lord Influenza and his followers have held the countryside in their grip. Corpses lay alongside the sick in kraals. Animals wandered in the fields unheard, unherded. Cows went unmilked. In the words, dramatically, of one contemporary living in the Transkei, witnessing this horror, the epidemic seems to threaten the existence of the entire race. As in most epidemics, when life is under direct threat, we've already seen it twice in two lectures, this is a common pattern, finger-pointing and blaming soon came to the fore, along many of the fissures in South African society. And in that way, some whites blamed Africans for recklessly spreading the disease as they fled from epidemic hotspots. There were even calls for Africans to be barred from the trains because it seemed as if they were the vectors, they were deliberately carrying the disease. Similarly, Africans blamed whites and their government. They believed that they were out to kill them. For instance, when relief workers in the Ciskei reported on their attempts to supply medicine and food and some kind of sustenance as they went around the Ciskei, they were preceded by a local, quote, telling the people that this disease was a device of the Europeans to finish off the native races of South Africa. And as it had not been quite successful, they were now sending out men with poison to complete the work of extermination. So all of those underlying suspicions, prejudices, hostilities come to the fore in the face of a deadly threat. We've seen it twice, we see it again. It is a permanent feature, it seems to me, of human response to epidemics, which place one's life at risk. Given that it was wartime, finger-pointing didn't stop just in South Africa. A few patriotic fingers were pointed at Germany, the enemy in World War I. And particularly, it was suggested that the Spanish flu was a consequence of the Germans' dastardly use of poison gas. One doctor, Newtonhague, insisted that, quote, Spanish flu is not a suitable name. German plague would be more accurate. One old woman told me, it's obvious. Germs? Germans. Moreover, local white politics provided its own brand of accusations. Several diehard members of General Herzog's National Party believed that General Botha's government had deliberately let the flu loose to wipe out his political opponents. Fueling this panic was this rising tide of corpses. Residents of the country's towns and cities were hard-pressed to cope with this accumulating number of corpses. In Cape Town, municipal carts, Scotch carts, toured the streets, picking up those who had died in the streets, at the roadside, or from homes where families hailed them and said, "We have a dead person here." Families resorted to all manner of transport to convey their loved ones to the cemetery. Cars, taxis, trolleys, even wheelbarrows. The office of the cemetery board in Cape Town was besieged by crowds wanting to arrange burials. Morgue attendants, undertakers, clergymen were swept off their feet by the immense demands placed on them. In Kimberley, funerals went on into the night by the light of car headlamps. Coffins were in short supply, making it necessary for some of the corpses to be buried only in wrapped up in a blanket. Many of these corpses were placed in a mass grave. There was not the labor nor the time to dig individual graves. One officiating clergyman in Kimberley recalled how African flu victims were buried in a fresh mass grave every day between 2 and 4 p.m., irrespective of their religion. He recalled, 25 bodies were placed in this mass grave, each in a blanket. We sang, I said prayers, and then a thin layer of soil was thrown over them. Then came the next 25 bodies. Usually 100 bodies were buried in this way every day, but sometimes it was 125 and once 150. That required 6 consecutive funeral services. I've rushed, in a sense, through this because I want to give you just a sense of the disaster enveloping the country, engulfing the country at such speed, with such magnitude. It's clear that influenza, which had such a devastating effect, was not ordinary influenza. It was not the usual seasonal flu. The H1N1 virus, which caused the influenza pandemic of 1918, was a wholly new strain, one to which no one in the world had prior immunity. Like ordinary flu, it was spread by coughing, by sneezing, and was therefore transmitted very effectively in crowded places. But unlike ordinary flu, it rapidly penetrated deep into the lungs of the victim, rather than lodging in the upper respiratory tract, which is the usual pattern of the flu virus. The H1N1 virus in 1918 had a characteristic that it went down deep into the lungs very early on. And in this, it seems, was the source of its particular virulence, because its presence, its fulminating presence, deep in the lungs, right at the beginning of the disease, laid the way open for viral and bacterial pneumonia, which were the chief killers in 1918. If one looks at the symptoms, labored breathing, not surprisingly, given that the lungs were the primary target of the fulminating virus, a high fever, a crackling sound from the lungs as the taking in of air was compromised, bleeding from the nose or mouth, and most frightening of all for contemporaries, as it became more and more difficult for oxygen to be circulated by the blood, a deep tinging of the skin. Here is one such victim. The caption says, "This illustrates a pronounced degree of the heliotrope cyanosis." Heliotrope is this increasingly blue pallor, and cyanosis is dark, dark blue. This patient is not in physical distress, but his prognosis is almost hopeless. And so, to these sounds of people gasping for air, to nosebleeds, bleeding from the mouth, to crackling sounds from the lungs, and this dark pallor, all added to the horror of Spanish flu, frightening both patients and their families. And also, it was told to me by a man who had lived through this, a characteristic telltale odor. He described it as, it was like musty straw. It was so pungent, it just came into your nostrils with a bang. So all the senses of people clustered around the bed of a sick person were assailed by this horrific scene in front of them, of their family, their friends, their loved ones, turning heliotrope, coughing, spluttering, crackling, and this straw-like smell. Developing primary viral pneumonia usually meant death in 3 days. Indeed, the colloquial label used in South Africa was "3-dag siekte," 3-day disease. That if you contracted it, day 3 was the day in which you either died, or if you survived, then it was likely you would survive. But of course, in this pre-antibiotic age, secondary bacterial pneumonia produced the same result, though not as swiftly. In many young adults with a strong immune system, infection triggered, it seems, an immune over-response, so massive that, in effect, it caused acute respiratory disease and death itself. This may explain a very distinctive, a very characteristic feature of the Spanish flu, which marks it out from all other flus. Have a look at this. I hope you can. This is a page from the cemetery register of West End Cemetery in Kimberley. You'll see October 1918. Here's the dates, all on the 13th and then on the 14th down there. That's just a single page. But what I want you to look at in particular is the age of those who died. And as you can see, cause of death, influenza, uniformly young. Anything catch your eye, if indeed you can see it, about those ages? They are relatively young. Spanish flu worldwide had the highest mortality amongst young adults, 18 to 40. And that's completely at odds with the usual flu death, pattern of flu deaths. There, usually, it is the very young and the very old. And this is something very distinctive, and it has exercised the minds of virologists, epidemiologists, at great length to try and understand why it was so deadly to those who ought to have been the most robust and the strongest. It's very possible, it's suggested, that one of the reasons is this immune over-response by young adults. This response to the presence of the virus deep in the lung triggered amongst young people whose immune system is strongest, an over-response. That's perhaps one explanation, the physiological explanation. But there may also be a social explanation, in that category of people are the breadwinners, particularly the young men in the world of 1918. Men who would have been reluctant to stay at home because they were the source of a family's income. And so perhaps they contracted it, did not stay at home, were not nursed, and succumbed to a disease which they never were able to prevent going further because they continued to work. So there may well be a social explanation as well as a physiological explanation. But the end product is very apparent from these horrific figures of those who are least, one would have expected, least likely to succumb, piling up in the graves and cemeteries of the world, not just in South Africa. For doctors were at a loss to know what to do to treat the disease. All they could recommend was nursing. One doctor admitted, "We had a rough idea that care was necessary, that fresh air was essential, but as to medical treatment, our minds were fogged." And so the medicines which they recommended really were panic measures, anything which they thought might assist. So if you look at the kind of medication prescribed by doctors, they range from aspirin, quinine, Epsom salts, phenol, cinnamon tablets, special flu mixture concocted by chemists under immense pressure, and also a vaccine made in emergency conditions with almost every possible pathogen added to it. They quite simply had no answer to this new novel strain, this deadly strain of influenza. All of these were equally useless. Poignantly, the son of a Cape Town doctor wrote to me about his father's reaction when a newly married couple he'd been treating for Spanish flu died within days of each other. The son of this doctor, who saw these two young people recently married die, said, "It was then I first saw my father cry. He was sobbing in sorrow and in frustration at his impotence." Nor were biomedical practitioners alone in the inability to prescribe something. And in the absence of any definite cure, an obvious treatment, a guarantee, other medical systems put forward other methods, or equally unsuccessful in treatment, which opened the way, as it always does when there's an epidemic and there's no single treatment, no single cure, for quacks to peddle their wares, making grand claims, or for commercial opportunists to seize the opportunity to exploit the fear and panic. For instance, seizing the opportunity, the manufacturers of Commando brandy advertised their brandy as particularly effective in keeping Spanish flu at bay. Similarly, the makers of something called Sibylline skin antiseptic ointment said, buy this, apply it to the inside of your nostrils, and you will be guaranteed to keep the infection at bay. When people are desperate, they will seize anything which offers the possibility of life against death. And you can see the opportunities provided and exploited by manufacturers were often quite unscrupulous. In the end, in the absence of any sure cure or treatment, most South Africans probably put their faith in folk remedies, in patent medicines, in time-honored nostrums, and practices like fleeing to remote areas or self-imposed isolations. Many Africans turned to traditional herbalists, to sangomas, or witch finders to check the disease. As a result, smelling out, given that the belief was that a disease as devastating and catastrophic as this must have been sent by someone malevolent wishing to kill members of your family, and therefore it was necessary to smell them out, so you need a witch finder. As a consequence, smelling out by those who had been, of those who were deemed responsible, increased markedly in the wake of the Spanish flu, as people sought to identify who was it who was so with such an evil intention, sent this flu to kill members of my family. Attacks on such people increased in the wake of the flu, as witches and wizards were identified and had to be punished and indeed killed for their malevolence. If we look at official responses, the state, the new South African state, newly created in 1910, relied particularly on biomedicine. And this is the mode of treatment which enjoyed government support, such as it was. And so the medical assistance which the state provided was exclusively of the biomedical nature. For instance, the then non-existent, there was no Department of Health, no central, no national Department of Health. There were three doctors who made up a sub-department in Pretoria. They circulated to the public leaflets with advice on how to treat the Spanish flu, which they gleaned from Britain. They advertised for doctors and nurses so that they could try and steer these doctors and nurses to areas where there were no doctors or nurses. They also put an enormous amount of pressure on the government laboratories to come up with something, some kind of vaccine, which anti-flu vaccine, which would still the panic, which could demonstrate that they were actually trying to do something. Though, as I indicated, what went into these vaccines was just blunderbuss. The lab technicians and doctors really just provided something under enormous protest, saying this is completely at odds with the usual procedure. There's no testing, there's no experimentation, there's no analysis. Government put pressure for the Institute of Medical Research and government labs to come up with something that they could offer. All of these were ineffective. No coordinated health, public health policy response. A bit here, a bit there, really about as effective as trying to stop a wildfire with an armful of watering cans. Really, very, very little effect on this runaway felt fire of the Spanish flu. Given that the central government's efforts were so unsuccessful, were so poorly organized, were so lacking in systematic use of resources, the best coordinated official actions came from municipalities. They were left with the responses which were on the ground with a degree of resources. And so they appealed for volunteers from the public. Public-spirited volunteers were called on to do their bit during the war. And that patriotic duty was often emphasized. Our soldiers are doing their bit to defeat Germany. Now it is time for you to do your bit in your patriotic duty to keep at bay, to prevent the Spanish flu. And so they set up temporary hospitals staffed by volunteers. They opened relief depots to supply food, soup, and medicine to badly affected households. Here's one of these leaflets from Johannesburg listing all the special depots where soup, where food, and anti-flu mixture would be available. They helped to disinfect households where cases had occurred, and they conducted cleanups of what were identified as insanitary areas. Again, this almost knee-jerk response, we must do something, unhealthy, unhygienic, insanitary areas, they must in some way be involved. So clean them up, clean the streets. Gallons and gallons of J's fluid poured through the streets of South Africa in an attempt to do something, to be shown that there was not an absence of passivity, but as I indicated, in reality, with almost no effect. Here you can see City Hall, Cape Town, bottom end of Long Market Street, the queue stretching around the City Hall of people waiting to get food, to get relief, to get anti-flu mixture, to get soup. If one looks, there's a soldier there, still wartime, a number of nurses. It appears to be largely women. And I'm still puzzled as to what these two men are doing here up on ladders. Cleaning windows seems to be a very, very considerable luxury in the midst of an epidemic. But maybe that's your job, to clean a window. So there are things going on here which I cannot explain, but which certainly merit comment and analysis. But this would have been the scene in most cities of South Africa. Cape Town was one quite well organized, so probably quite considerable supplies available, but largely run by volunteers. In many ways, this was where the fight was at the heart. In municipalities, in towns and cities, it was municipalities and town councils which really offered the most significant response to the Spanish flu. The Union Defence Force was also prevailed upon to lend a hand against the Spanish flu. Once the flu had waned in the military camps of South Africa, it of course controlled many of the country's doctors and nurses because they had joined up to fight in World War I. And so once the military camps were relatively free of Spanish flu, the Union Defence Force directed its soldiers, some of its nurses, some of its military medical officers to areas designated because they lacked nurses and lacked doctors. Some were therefore dispatched to individual towns and villages. Others were organized into three field ambulances to tour the rural Transkei and Transvaal to dispense emergency medical care. In several places, the Defence Force not only supplied medical equipment from their military store, but they also admitted to military hospitals civilians in a desperate effort to provide some kind of care. To Kimberley, the Defence Force sent its acting director of medical services, Colonel Alexander Orenstein. He was the acting director of military medical services. Kimberley's plight was dire beyond belief. And in desperation, because the municipality was completely overwhelmed by the magnitude of the disaster which had engulfed it, in desperation, they sent a telegram to the Department of Defense and said, please send Colonel Orenstein to take charge. Our efforts are faltering. The words of the telegram read, please come at once. You will be in absolute control. A marker of the desperation in Kimberley, where even the town council was unable to deal with this tsunami, this overwhelming tidal wave of death. with this mandate, with this blank check, Orenstein took the overnight train down to Kimberley from Pretoria, and within 24 hours he'd created a comprehensive, tight-knit system which embraced all local doctors, all local pharmacists, all local hospitals, and rationalised their efforts. For example, he divided the town into 12 medical districts. Each district had a doctor allocated to it by Orenstein. That doctor had to deal with all calls for that district. Pharmacists were instructed to dispense only 3 standard anti-flu mixtures, and doctors were told that they could confine their prescriptions only to those 3 anti-flu mixtures. So a very tight authoritarian attempt to systematize the counter measures in Kimberley, because everything else had collapsed and Orenstein was given a blank check. In Bloemfontein, there was a similarly authoritarian counter-offensive run by the municipality, which really took powers to itself. One contemporary called it, it's a sort of ad hoc Soviet system, which is, I think, perhaps the first time the word Soviet has been used in a positive sense in South Africa. But here, the town's doctors, the doctors in Bloemfontein, dug in their heels. They refused to be told where they would provide their service, and they would not confine themselves to a single district, as those in Kimberley agreed to do. The speed, the extent, the horror of the Spanish flu in South Africa. It's estimated that perhaps over 50% of South Africa's population went down with the flu in the space of a month. So that's probably about 2.5-3 million people of the total population of just over 5.5 actually succumbed. It meant that quite soon the flu began to wane, because so many people had contracted it and gained a temporary degree of immunity that there were fewer and fewer people left who had not been left alive, who had not been exposed to flu and had a degree of resistance to it. And so, in the words of one contemporary doctor, as the flu, after this intense, dramatic surge across the country, seemed quite rapidly to reach a plateau and then to ebb quite speedily, there was not left just the same amount of fuel to feed the flu's fire. You have the sense of so many people had been struck down, those who survived had a degree of immunity, and so there were not new cases, uninfected people. And so the flu quite rapidly ebbed. So 6 intensive, horrific weeks, and then it almost seemed to go out with a squeak rather than with a bang. But some 300,000 South Africans did not survive. About 300,000 died during those 6 weeks. As I said, that's about 6% of the South African population. That's a mortality rate exceeded by only 2 other countries in the world that we know. So about 6%. The 2 worst hit, Western Samoa, island in the Pacific, 25% of the population dead in 6 weeks. Not a large population, but a quarter of the population. And the other country where a slightly larger rate, India, just over 6%, so slightly more percentage-wise than South Africa, though in absolute terms, many more than 300,000. So one needs to ask the question, what was it about South Africa that made the flu so lethal in this country? And one can speculate about that. And one looks to the underlying nature of the society and its infrastructure. What facilitated that rapid spread? And one thing which stands out markedly in the case of South Africa, compared certainly to almost every other country on the continent of Africa, is its well-developed transport system. A well-developed railway system which facilitated the transmission of flu far and wide. Secondly, the high number of young men on the move in South Africa. Soldiers, as I mentioned to you, also migrant workers. South Africa had an unusually large number of young men on the move at this time. The fact also is that the first encounter of the majority of the population with Spanish flu was not with that less lethal first wave, but with the deadly second wave. So if one takes together the infrastructure, the fact that an unusually large percentage of the population were mobile and they had the means to move widely around the country because of the well-developed railway system, and the fact that the majority of them encountered not the first wave, but the second wave, the deadly second wave, that seems to begin to offer some explanation, possible explanation, as to why South Africa was so badly hit. If we look at the breakdown of the 300,000 deaths, approximately 78% were African, 12% those labelled coloured, 8% those labelled white, and about 2% those labelled Indian. If we look at those percentages and compare them with the percent that each of those designated racial groups made up within the overall population, it's very clear that Africans and coloureds were far more heavily hit than whites and Indians. Their percentage in the overall population was a good deal of Africans was a good deal lower than 78%. But 78% of the deaths were of Africans. I think the African percentage of the total population then was at about 68%. It suggests that living conditions, particularly amongst Africans and coloureds, was conducive to the spread of the disease, but also it suggests that particularly in those communities, the ability to stop the infection, because the infection was very widespread indeed, but the ability to stop that infection turning into death, becoming lethal, was less well developed in those communities. Poor physical condition, lack of nursing, lack of knowledge about nursing may have been decisive in ensuring that a larger proportion of those two communities was struck down by death and not just by contracting the flu, but actually dying of the flu. The majority of those, as we've already seen, were in the 18 to 40 age bracket. Of these, men were more vulnerable than women, which again suggests that if they were the breadwinners, maybe that's why men were more vulnerable than women in that age category. The only category of women in this age group who were at special risk were those who were pregnant. If we look geographically at the spread of the flu, there's some very telling evidence. This map shows the levels, the rates of death by shading. So completely white, the lowest number, 0 to 20 deaths per 1,000. Slightly speckled, 21 to 35 deaths per 1,000. Darker, more than 35 deaths per 1,000. And if you look at the map, you will see a pattern which suggests the heaviest spread going up along here, along what is then the Western Transvaal, not in Gauteng or Transvaal, Johannesburg, and then around in the northern part of what is today Limpopo, little in the then Eastern Transvaal, what is today Mpumalanga, Natal, relatively lightly affected, and Transkei and Ciskei, very heavily affected. You look at that map, and you think, well, is there any logic? Is there any pattern? And indeed, there is a pattern, because the railway lines go exactly along these paths. And if the first wave came in through Natal, giving a degree of immunity to the deadly second wave, that explains the relatively light number, a small number of deaths in Natal, and likewise on the Witwatersrand because of migrant workers, miners particularly, coming in from Durban, from Natal, and going straight up to the Witwatersrand. It rather looks as if the pathways along which the deadly second wave moved were ones which were closely associated with ports or railway junctions where the flu broke out. Cape Town, Port Elizabeth and East London, and then right in the heart of the Karoo, that big railway junction at Da'ar. There's another very telling bit of evidence to suggest this differential pattern, to explain this differential pattern. If we look at two neighbouring districts in the Transkei, if we look at Mount Frere, there's Mount Frere, and we look at adjoining district of Mount Aleph, Mount Frere, Mount Aleph, and you'll see Mount Frere is shaded very dark, and Mount Aleph very light. There's not much to distinguish living conditions in the two districts, but there is something which distinguishes the two. Mount Frere is closest to the railway line that comes in from Da'ar and the Eastern Cape. Mount Aleph, the nearest railway line, is one that comes from Natal. So the suggestion, the hypothesis, is that this really sums up South Africa being invaded almost simultaneously by the two waves. The first wave, very infectious, but not particularly deadly, coming in through Natal and the railway-linked areas, likewise, and the Witwatersrand, and somewhere like Mount Aleph. The second wave coming in through Cape Town, deadly, and spreading it all along the railway line linked to Cape Town, and particularly through the Aar, migrant workers going into back to the Transkei. This also perhaps suggests why miners in Kimberley should have been so heavily hit compared to miners on the Witwatersrand. The mortality rates are vastly different, and the conditions under which they lived in compounds were not really very, were not dissimilar. So again, one is looking for some kind of explanation, and it seems to me this hypothesis of being infected almost simultaneously by the second wave and the, by the first wave and the second wave explains what this pattern of deaths provides. But we need to go further than just the sheer horror of the 300,000 people who died. You need to remember, if you want to understand the full toll of the Spanish flu, the number of pregnant mothers who died meant a large number of children were not born. The loss of those children, those still to be borns, we should take into account as well. Moreover, in many cases, a non-fatal bout of the disease was enough to cause a miscarriage or spontaneous abortion. For decades after 1918, therefore, the mark of the Spanish flu remained on South Africa's demographic structure in the form of a reduced number of those who had been between 18 and 40 in 1918, their numbers reduced by many thousands, and also reduced by the number who were not born in 1919 because their mothers, mothers-to-be, had died in the flu back in 1918. We can see this change in the demographic structure beginning to work its way through the stages of life. When we look at the enrollment figures for primary school in 1925, what was then called Sub A, look at the enrollment figures for Sub A in 1925. They were reduced. If you work backwards, those are the those missing from the expected numbers, the children who were not born 6 years earlier in 1919. So if we want to get some kind of sense of the extent of the of the magnitude of the demographic impact of the Spanish flu, we need to go well beyond those 300,000 along the lines I suggested. Sorry. And then we need to go further than just sheer demographics as well. The death of a parent, of a spouse, of a child had emotional, psychological, social and material consequences for individuals well beyond just the demographic. The death of a breadwinner could produce a serious financial effect on the rest of the family. For instance, I found poignantly in the one of the journals of the Dutch Reformed Church an appeal from a flu widow whose husband had died in the Spanish flu, asking for some kind of assistance. She wrote, "My dear spouse died of flu, leaving me in poverty and debt with 5 children. Pray for acceptance and strength for me. I intend to go to the diamond diggings to see if I can make a living there. I will give a tithe to the Lord. Ask him for delivery and help for me." There's one poignant episode of a family which had been completely destabilized in financial terms by the loss of the breadwinner. This flu widow, 5 children. What happened to her? What happened to those children? Those two are consequences of the Spanish flu. For the hundreds of thousands of children orphaned by the epidemic, 1918 would have been at least as traumatic a year for them as for that widow. One flu orphan recalled, in 1965, she recalled, "I was taken in by my relatives as their child. My 4 brothers and sisters were scattered. We never got together again." In most African, Indian, and colored families, such incorporation into extended families was the norm, but amongst whites, it seems to have been far less common. Consequently, always anxious about the future of Afrikaners, the Dutch Reformed Church mounted a special appeal to raise funds for flu orphans. The Dutch Reformed Church raised £120,000 to provide accommodation in orphanages for flu orphans. Other denominations followed suit, but nothing like as extensively as the Dutch Reformed Church. As a result, by 1926, 16 new orphanages had been erected in South Africa, and the number of existing ones had been enlarged. The state agreed to subsidize the living costs of flu orphans lodged in these institutions. If we're looking at the history of orphans and orphanages in South Africa, the Spanish flu, therefore, is a huge watershed. It really transformed the provision for white orphans out of all recognition. And then we must think in terms of the emotional costs. Enduring personal effects are not as easy to see, but one must easily anticipate mass grief of the sort which you can see captured in this memorial service held in the little Free State village of Frankfurt in 1919 for those who had died in the Spanish flu. This must have been the norm across the whole of South Africa in 1919. In which reports tell of cemeteries being thronged week after week by families who had lost a member in the Spanish flu as they came to lay flowers or pay tribute to the person who had died. And then, again, poignantly, looking at the in memoriam column in the newspapers, every October of 1919, I went through to about the 1930s, a whole clutch of in memoriam to so-and-so who had died in that Black October of 1918. Perhaps most summing up this grief which endured and endured and endured. In 1998, I spoke to a man who was 88 years old who had lost his mother in 1918 when he was 10. He said to me, an 88-year-old man, "I still miss her." Also physical consequences and psychiatric consequences. In the 1920s, numerous cases of depression, impaired heart and respiratory function, deafness, susceptibility to other diseases like encephalitis lethargica, nephritis, Parkinson's disease, were identified as having increased markedly, and contemporary medical opinion associated them with people who had had the Spanish flu, had survived, but with impaired health. Nor were many people's religious beliefs left unscathed by this dreadful experience. Rampant death on such an enormous, apparently undiscriminating scale tested the faith of many people mightily. Some found their existing religions' explanations inadequate and wanting. For example, enough African adherents of traditional religion were attracted to Christianity for some missionaries to speak in public of, quote, the compensating blessings accompanying the ravages of the recent influenza epidemic as seen in the awakened, interest among the heathen and a desire for the word of God. So conversions to Christianity on a significant scale, such as to attract a comment, a rather unfeeling comment like that from a missionary. On the other hand, some African Christians were so disappointed by the inability of mainline Christianity to protect their families or to comfort them adequately in their loss that they turned their backs on the established churches, and spurred by divine visions, they founded their own independent Zionist churches. And there's a blossoming of Zionist churches in Africa across the board in 1919, largely out of unhappiness and alienation from mainline Christianity during the Black October. Some very devout Christians, both black and white, went even further. They interpreted the epidemic as a signal that the millennium was in the offing. They began to preach this message and the urgent need to prepare for the second coming, which they said, this is the sign, the second coming is about to be upon us. In the environment, you must think of war, of revolution, of social angst, vulnerability to Spanish flu. Such a millennial response is not unexpected, even if it lasted only temporarily. This sense of vulnerability, which Black October so intensified, also underlay the sales, the record sales of life insurance in the following months, particularly as it was widely forecast that there would be another wave of the epidemic bound to follow very soon indeed. The country's insurance firms, having paid out significant amounts to the families of those who had died in Black October and had been insured, took the opportunity to make lots and lots of publicity for the fact that insurance, life insurance, was critical. Here's an advert which was screened in the bioscopes of South Africa in 1919, funded by the insurance industry. The epidemic may return. Be prepared. Insure to the hilt. Do it now. The impact of this and the angst in many South Africans' minds meant that in 1919, an estimated £20 million of new life insurance was written. In proportion terms, the greatest number of new life insurance policies in South African insurance history. 20 million now is not such a great figure, but in 1919, in proportion terms, that's the greatest number of new policies ever. A South African record. In the words of the chairman of one of South Africa's big insurance companies, his annual report says, it is, in our opinion, all to the good that the public should have been impressed by the lesson of this severe experience to the extent of making provision as never before against the risks of death. At a public level too, the experience of this frightful frightful Black October underlined the need for administrative action to try and put in place some kind of barrier, some kind of bulwark to avoid a catastrophe of the same proportions yet again. Many pointed the finger particularly at the need for some kind of organized public health system. which had been so obviously and markedly lacking in 1918. And so, right at the end of 1918, instructions were given for a Public Health Act, Public Health Bill, to be drafted rapidly. And it was tabled as early as February 1919 and went through Parliament like a knife through butter because of the fear that if something better organised was not in place, South Africa would be found deeply wanting if another wave of the epidemic arose. And so in 1919, South Africa's first Public Health Act was passed, setting up a national department of public health with its own minister. At a more local level, preventive measures were instituted, port health regulations were tightened up to try and prevent the arrival of infectious diseases on ships. Ships were told to radio ahead, taking advantage of the new technology, if there were outbreaks of any infectious diseases on board. Emergency contingency plans were drawn up, and indeed the new Public Health Department kept insisting municipalities, have you got an emergency plan? Have you got in place where things will be lodged, stored, places that will be used for relief depots, temporary hospitals, etc., and kept coming back at them every couple of years, have you updated, have you updated? A mark of the fear and anxiety to prevent another horror like 1918. Elementary health education for the general public was pushed, particularly by the Dutch Reformed Church, which said Afrikaners have been shown to lack basic nursing skills. What a huge effect this would have had in 1918 in preventing deaths. So across the country, wide-ranging popular health education, particularly in women's magazines directed at Afrikaners. And finally, a recognition that poor housing was in some way related to the devastation of Black October. In 1920, South Africa's first Housing Act was passed. First time ever that the state accepted the principle, even though it was not rolled out on a massive scale. First time ever the state accepted the principle that state provides housing for the public at a subsidized rate. Even the private sector recognized the importance of this. The chairman of the Cape Town Chamber of Commerce, Richard Stutterford, recognizing that the flu had shown up poor housing and poor living conditions for many people who he had thought would be middle class, but they had nonetheless succumbed, persuaded the Chamber of Commerce, the Cape Town Chamber of Commerce, to set up a new, airy, well-ventilated suburb where housing in spacious areas would be available relatively cheaply. £10,000 he donated, the Chamber of Commerce, similar amount to establish the new garden village of Pinelands. Similarly, with an idea of the need for fresh air to take people out of the cloistered, insanitary, poor hygiene of slums, the Cape Times mounted an appeal for funds to provide fresh air camp for young children. The Cape Times Fresh Air Fund, which still functions today, set up in 1919 in response to the disaster of Black October. And finally, to pick up a theme I talked about yesterday, the bubonic plague, I said yesterday, had triggered action to provide separate residential areas, locations for Africans, for Indians. I talked yesterday about Ndabeni and New Brighton and Ginsberg and Klipspruit. Well, the Spanish flu took that even further. Yet another round of separation of locations built in the wake of what the Spanish flu revealed about poor housing conditions. And so Langa in Cape Town, Bato near Bloemfontein, and the Western Native Township in Johannesburg were all set up in the wake of the Spanish flu as a way of extending even further residential segregation for Africans and for Indians. And in 1923, the government passed what was called the Natives Urban Areas Act, which sought to put on a national basis the principle that Africans should be located separately in urban areas, residential segregation. The words of the Prime Minister in winding up the debate on this act, General Smuts, are as follows. If the principles of the bill were fairly applied in South Africa, we should remove what was today a grievance and a menace to health and living conditions in the country. And so what you can see is that the Spanish flu was both an accelerator of existing trends, as we have seen in the previous two epidemics, but also it was the initiator of new features. It brought into South African society a number of new features which had not been there before. The changed demographic structure of South Africa, bereft and broken families, perhaps shattered for all times financially, emotionally, psychologically. Several hundred thousand orphans and flu survivors, people affected psychiatrically, emotionally, scarred for the rest of their lives. In these respects, the Spanish flu was both an accelerator and an initiator. And perhaps in that regard, it might be compared to that other horseman of the apocalypse war. Or perhaps it's even more sinister, even more pernicious than war, because the Spanish flu made no distinction between soldiers and civilians. One flu survivor told me 60 years after the flu, "I don't hope for anything like that flu again. It's worse, much worse than a war." Thank you. People who've got to leave, give us a moment or two, then we'll take questions.